Welcome, guys, to episode 85 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week I'm bringing to you a man who I myself have followed for several decades now. He is a retired LAPD officer and also probably the most well-known face in the UFC, and that man is John McCarthy. So we delve into a host of topics in this conversation. We talk about his early life, his career in LAPD, some of the areas he worked in, the way he helped teach combatives within PD, and then also we transition to his time in the UFC, the early years, the change in the rules, drug testing, and then the application of martial arts for civilians as well. So we really covered a whole host of topics in this hour, and it was phenomenal. But I want to thank him again ahead of time. He just got hired by Bellator to be the commentator for their fights, so he was extremely busy. Took time from his schedule just to reach out to the first responders of the world. And I was, again, as always, extremely grateful for that. So before we start, as I always say, please go to iTunes, rate the show. Please find this or one of your favorite episodes and tell a friend. Tell them to tell a friend. Let's get this thing growing and growing and growing. It is snowballing like now. It's so exciting. And that being said, without further ado, I introduce to you Big John McCarthy. Enjoy. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast, John. Thank you so much for taking time out your busy day to come on. Where are we finding you on planet Earth today?
Planet Earth, I'm in Las Vegas.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I want to start at the very beginning because I know a lot of people have seen you. You know, obviously, every time there's pretty much any MMA fight, you're more often than not going to be the guy wearing the gloves. The latex gloves, as it were. But I know you have a very interesting story, even from your family dynamic. So can you tell me where you were born and what your family unit was like? So what your mom and dad did and how many siblings that you had?
Oh, my God. I was born basically in Los Angeles, California. I was born and raised there. I had one sister that was an older sister. She used to beat the hell out of me. And my dad was a LA police officer. He worked for the LAPD, and my mother was a teacher. She was actually a PE teacher. She's a hell of an athlete, so she got to do all kinds of cool stuff. She always used to make me look bad because if I played Little League and I played well, she'd be the one going to the parents' game and hitting four home runs or something like that on that day. So she was always the great athlete.
Oh, brilliant. Now, whereabouts in Los Angeles were you?
We started out in, I guess, Linwood, and then went to Lakewood and ended up in La Puente and then Hacienda Heights. So.
Okay, because I spent a few years in that area. I worked for Anaheim Fire for a few years, and I lived up in Burbank and then moved down to Huntington Beach.
Okay.
So I know North Hollywood area pretty well. So was your dad around during the Watts riots then?
He was around during the Watts riots. My dad went on LAPD. I think his academy class was started in 59. He graduated in 1960. And so the Watts riots were somewhere around 65. So he was definitely part of that. He was there. My dad had a pretty cool career. He's considered the godfather of modern day SWAT, and he was big with the first the first SWAT team was Los Angeles Police Department, and my dad was a big part of implementing the tactics that are still used today with a lot of special weapons and tactics teams.
Wow. Now, was he in the military before that? Did he go straight into police?
No, he was in the military. He was in the Navy.
Okay. Brilliant. All right. So when you were young, had you already had aspirations to get into law enforcement?
You know what? I was lucky in the fact that because of what my dad did, he used to take me everywhere. And he would take me on their training, a lot of the trainings that they would do. And, be it at Universal Studios, they would do training, and that he would hide me in places and they had to search for me and doing systematic searches, or he would allow me to do, rappelling out of helicopters or spy rigging or all kinds of cool stuff. So I always loved what he did. And you know, I got to that rebellious stage somewhere when I was, you know, 15, 16 and thought that, yeah, the police officers that he worked with were cool, but the ones that were writing me tickets and things like that, I didn't like too much. And I was definitely not going to be a police officer. That's something that I just kind of, after a while, thought, well, you're going to end up, you know, doing one of two things. You're going to get yourself in trouble and end up in jail, or you can end up putting people in jail. So which one's it going to be?
One's definitely more favorable than the other.
Yeah, it is.
So early on then, before, when you were saying you weren't going to go into law enforcement, what was it on your mind that you wanted to get into? And what was it that put you on that other side of the law for a while?
When I first went to college, I was looking at becoming a marine biologist because I loved sharks and I was fascinated by them. I would go out into the ocean and fish for them, swim with them. It didn't matter. I love sharks. But then I quickly realized that, you know, marine biology is a lot more than liking sharks, and it's about, you know, seaweed and other things. And it was like, well, that's just not going to be me. So I was bouncing a lot in places to make money. And it just got to a point where I realized, you know what, being a police officer is probably something that I'm more cut out to be than doing some of these other jobs. I'm going to get in trouble doing these other jobs. So that's when I started applying.
Right. Now, how far back was it, or how young were you when you got into the martial arts?
Oh my God. Well, you know, my dad was very big into what he considered real combat. And my dad did not consider a lot of the martial arts when it came to a standard, you know, Okinawan style or, you know, Kyokushin karate. He was not a big proponent. He was a huge proponent of boxing and wrestling, amateur wrestling. And so that's the martial arts that I got to participate in. You know, a lot of people didn't look at them in those days as a martial art, but now, you know, because of MMA, they're much more regarded they are a martial art. So I was doing amateur wrestling and I was doing boxing from the time I was 7 years old.
Oh wow! But now, obviously, those are two of the mainstays of a successful MMA fighter.
Yeah, you know, and I was lucky enough later on in my life when I was 30 or so, I met Horian Gracie and, you know, the martial arts, as far as, you know, most people would look at it with jiu-jitsu, is where I really came into the standard, you know, section of martial arts, and then just continued to, you know, learn all the different types of things that I could that were part of what made MMA what it was.
Right. So how old were you when you did go through police academy and join LAPD?
I was 21, I think, when I went in, and 22 when I got out. So I graduated in 1986 in January, and I had my birthday was in the middle of my academy class. So 21 years old when my academy started, and 22 when I actually got to go be a police officer.
And what areas of LA did you work over your career?
The first area that I worked was Southwest Division, which is in South Central Los Angeles. It's basically where the LA Coliseum is at. University of Southern California is there. It's a very diverse community. Had a large Japanese population at the time, a huge Hispanic population, and a large Black population were there. A smaller white, not many, but it was. It was a great area to work because it had everything and it was fast. There was a lot of crime happening, but you learned as far as, hey, you know, hopefully you learn, you know, 98-99% of the people out there are just good, hardworking people trying to get by, live their lives, you know, feed their families. And there's the, you know, the 1-2% that tries to make their lives difficult. And my job was to make that 1-2% make their lives difficult.
Right. Now, was that South Central as far as the Crenshaw area that was very bad with the gangs?
Yes, that's where Crenshaw runs through.
Right. Yeah, that would be a pretty steep learning curve.
You know what? It was everywhere that you go, especially in a place like Los Angeles, the LAPD had what was called 18 geographical divisions, and then those were broken up into bureaus, and that was South Bureau was part of it. Southeast Division, Southwest Division, 77th Division, Harbor, since it went all the way down, the thing was South. Those were all South Bureau divisions, but they were a good time. It was a fun place to work. It taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about people, and I was glad that I got to work in those areas at the beginning of my career.
All right. Now, were you two to a squad car back then?
Yes. Yeah. I would have just about everywhere in LA that you have what's called an A car. And an A car is two officers. At that time, just coming out, I had a training officer and I was the probationary officer. And most units, whether it was a training officer or not, were two men or two person units. The only ones that were singles were either the supervisors or report writing cars. We used to call them U-boats.
All right. And is that how they still do it now?
Yep. Still doing it that way to this day.
Okay. So what would be your opinion then of all these departments that have a single officer to a car? I'm a firefighter. Like I said, I'm not masquerading to be anything to do with law enforcement, but obviously we're hand in hand as far as what we respond to and the type of job. But for the officer safety and able to respond side, it seems like if you have the manpower, two to a car would be safer for them and for who they're responding to.
Oh, it absolutely is. And it all comes down to it's economics. You know, my son works for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's to this day, and he, is a training officer. So many times he is a two-man unit because he's training somebody, but when he's not, he can be a single person unit. And the way LA County Sheriffs do is they'll send usually two cars to the problem, but that's never going to be as good as that that two person unit, because those two people are getting there at exactly the same time. And or there's, if you're working as a single unit and you're waiting, you're going to wait for someone. So you're coming in together. So then the people that are calling, they're waiting. And it's economics. When you look at a single officer in a car, that means that that department is trying to put out more cars. So it looks like there's more officers out there, when in actuality, there's not as many officers, or there is the same amount of officers. And those officers are usually not going to do the same things as that two-person unit, because there's only them by themselves and they can't see 360 degrees all the time. And so they're going to go about doing their job in a little bit different way.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had several officer shootings in the Central Florida area recently. And I wonder, if they were a two-person car, would that event have transpired the same way?
Well, a long time ago, I came up with an acronym of DOA, which was not dead on arrival, which is the way most people look at it, but it was, what did it take for an officer to end up getting hurt or being put in a situation where someone was trying to hurt him? And it was, the D stood for desire. When there was nothing that an officer can do about a suspect's desire to hurt him. If someone has that desire, they're going to have it. There's nothing you can do about it. It's going to be there. But they're not going to act upon that desire if they don't feel like they can get away with it. So then you also have the A, which is the ability. And that ability is, there's nothing that I can do about the way someone trains. There's nothing that they could do about the way I trained. If I trained in hand-to-hand combat, if I trained with a weapon and trained to be very proficient with it, all of those things are skills that I possess that someone's going to have to deal with if I bring them, out because I need to, or if someone tries to bring their skills towards me. And then the last thing you have is that O, and that O is the opportunity. And when you have, you as the officer should have the opportunity as far as you're controlling it. It's a matter of, do you give it up based upon not even realizing you're giving it up and it being based upon your tactics and the way you do things, or are you giving it up just because you want to be someone that is not seen as a threat in the beginning, or you're trying to be nice, or these things. And it's a definite thought process that an officer has to go through, because when those three things come together, when the suspect has a desire to hurt you, they have the ability, and now you've handed them the opportunity, you can almost guarantee it's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a very unique perspective recently. I got to train with Tim Kennedy, you know, from the UFC, and he has a thing called Sheepdog Response, who is, yeah, you're probably familiar with them. So they came to actually my hometown, Ocala, and they did the law enforcement side, and then me and a bunch of firemen and some civilians did the civilian side. But through them, you know, I didn't realize that you know, some of these officers literally have limited rounds to even qualify with, and are issued, you know, so many bullets to do their job with, versus the special ops community that are out there training and training and training, and you know, they're given the ammunition that it takes to be as effective a soldier as they can. What was it like in LAPD?
Well, as far as the when it came to the LAPD, actually at the time that I was there, they qualified more than any other or required a qualification more than any department I knew. We had a, depending upon what you were, if you were trying to become a, what was a distinguished expert in shooting, you had to shoot your weapon at least once a month and qualify at a certain standard every month to be able to get to that. For the average officer, they had to qualify at least every other month. And then once a month, I mean, once every half year with a shotgun. And then if you were part of a rifle cadre, you had to qualify with that. If you were part of a slug cadre, you had to do that. So there was a lot of actual qualification. And all of that qualification was done with department rounds. Usually they were the ones paying for them. Sometimes if you went more than once, you had to pay for your ammunition to go qualify. But you know, we used to, you know, I taught for a long time at the academy, and there was 920 hours that a recruit would actually spend in the academy. And one of the things that we would try to talk to them about and tell them is be better than the 920. Look, don't think that once you get out of here, you're ready and you're prepared for anything. You need to always work to be better. You need to go train. If you want to be a professional, then you need to act like a professional and you need to do professional things. And professional people continually try to advance their knowledge and their abilities. And if you're not doing that, you're probably going to fall behind.
Right. So let's take you as an example. What did you do over and above, you know, the bare minimum when you were actively on the streets?
I constantly was at gyms doing different things. I was, you know, always working on my ability to defend myself hand to hand, because I always thought that was important, because if I could do things where I didn't have to hurt the suspect and I could control him, it made my career easier. And so that was a big part of what I did. I shot, you know, multiple times every month, at least once a week. I was on the range and I would pay for that. Now I see, but it's a matter of, you got to look at what's important. I wrote that off. It was part of my taxes. All those rounds I got to write off. And so there's a way of getting around. Yes, you're putting the money out, but it's an insurance policy. That's the way I always looked at it. You know, do I want to pay for the insurance policy of, oh, you know, Aflac will say, where if I get hurt, they're going to pay me money? Or do I want to put the money in a direction that I think is going to be beneficial to me getting myself out of any problem that there is? So I used to train all the time, and I made it a part of who I was. I brought other people into it, and I believe, you know, down to the, you know, my very core, if you are not training all the time to make yourself the best that you can be, then you're giving other people an opportunity to take something away from you that you don't want taken.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's the same with the firefighting too. I mean, if we're not training with all the things that we have to mitigate, then one of those things is going to kill us in the process. So
you go.
Yeah. All right. So with your martial arts, when you first entered the police academy and you had a wrestling background, you had a boxing background by that point, what did the defense or the combatives look like back then when you first went to school?
Back then it was a little bit different. You know, it was the one, you know, everyone's got their strengths and their weaknesses when it comes to an academy. And, you know, I was big and running was not one of my strengths, even though they tried to make me a frickin' marathon runner. But it was, when it came to the, we had what was called combat wrestling. That's what they called it. And that was where they would put you back to back. They would make you run around the track and they would put you back to back and you would spin, and you know, you would have to either choke your classmate to the point of them submitting and you being able to cuff them, or you choked them unconscious. And then right about that time was when chokeholds were being changed with the LAPD. So then it became, you had to just, you know, take them into custody. And so luckily I was good at that part. And I was the torture tool for my class, because my instructors would say, you know, McCarthy take off running, and they would look and go, all right, who's it going to be today? And I tried to go easy on a lot of my classmates, but there were certain ones that I didn't like too much. And if they were chosen, I put a little bit of pressure on it. But all of that was the fun part of the academy for me. There was the part, you know, that I didn't like a lot of the classroom work and stuff like that, because it just wasn't who I was. But the physical part and the grappling and those, I loved all the self-defense stuff.
Right. Well, let's follow that journey then. So you said you train with Horry and Gracie?
Yes, sir. Him and his brothers.
So what was the very first day of doing jiu-jitsu like for you? And then tell me about that journey after that.
Well, I'll backtrack a little bit. And what happened is, you had back in 1991, March of 91, we had an incident in L.A. with Rodney King. And there was – Rodney King was he was in a high-speed pursuit, and he finally pulled over. And if you go back and you watch everything that occurred, too much occurred. And we had officers that were utilizing a baton to try to gain compliance with a suspect, and then trying to get them in this perfect position. And it was not the way it was supposed to be done. So the Los Angeles Police Department put together this, what they call the Martial Arts Review Committee, to look at what the officers were being taught and see if that Martial Arts Review Committee could come up with something in a better fashion that would be better and safer for the officers and better and safer for the actual public. And I was put onto that committee, and there was a demonstration that was done. And I guess I wasn't giving it my full attention with the person that was putting it on, and because he was tossing around this kid, and you know, the kid came with him. And so we call it an uki. And he was allowing, you know, the uki was allowing himself to be tossed around. And the instructor looked at me at one point and says, doesn't seem like you believe this works. And I, you know, was trying to be very nice. And I said, excuse me. I said, he's letting you do that. It's different when he doesn't want that to happen. And he said, well, would you like to step up here? And I said, I'll step up there, but I'm not going to let you just do that, and I'm going to do something back to you. And he said, no, please step up here. And so I just took him down with a double leg takedown, and I ended up on top of him, and I started, you know, acting like I was going to hit him. And my boss yelled at me and told me, get off of him. And I got off him, and I picked him up, and I said, hey, you know, I'm sorry. And he goes, no. And I sat back down, and Horry and Gracie came and sat down next to me and started talking to me and saying, hey, what do you do? And, you know, and I said, what do you mean? And he says, you grapple. He says, have you done jujitsu? And I said, no, I've wrestled. And we started talking. He invited me to a school, and I went, and the first person that I ever rolled with was Hoyce. And he ended up arm barring me after about 5 minutes, and I fell in love. I immediately how did you do that? And I fell in love with what they did, and I just became a student. And I loved what Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, that's what it was called at the time. It's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but with the Gracies, it was Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And I became a student, and I started going every day, every night that I could, you know, at least 3 times a week. And that's how it started.
Amazing. It's funny because there's so much similarity between the same types of individual, male or female, but I guess you would call them the alphas, who go to that class and get submitted and get choked, or go to a CrossFit class and just are lying in a pool of sweat and vomit, and their response is, I love this, show me more, instead of the average person would be like, hell no, I'm never doing this again.
Yeah, you know, and everybody, it's so funny because, you know, I had opened up a school, and you learn, hey man, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And when you say that, it's, you know, it's, look, you have a choice here. Do I want to be the guy that is, you know, knows there are people out there that I can't deal with? I don't want to be that guy. I don't want someone that, you know, is close to me to be that guy or that girl. I want to know everything I can know, so I know how to deal with that. So when someone does something, I know the response. And you know, when I first rolled with Hoist, I was on top of him the whole time, man. And I thought, man, this guy's nothing. And all of a sudden, man, he's moving in. My arm gets separated from my body and he's torquing on my elbow. And I was like, how did you get your legs there? And how did you do that? And it fascinated me. And I just became just awestruck with the actual just jujitsu that they taught. And, you know, everyone's got choices. You just got to make the right ones.
Right. Now, which came first, them helping with the police combatives or your involvement with the UFC?
Oh, no. That was them helping with the police combatives was back in 91, and the first UFC was 1993. So it was a couple years later, basically.
Okay, so they were bringing Gracie Jiu-Jitsu to LAPD at that time.
Well, he was trying, and, you know, you had it was funny because the people that were on that panel, there was a lot, and there was a lot of great martial artists. And obviously Horian believed in what his system was. And one of the things that I did with him is I helped him come up with what he brought out as his grapple program, which was a police-based ability to handle combative suspects. And he went about, you know, putting that grapple, you know, together, and along with me helping him, and it became a big, you know, big seller for him. And it worked, and it wasn't what LAPD bought. They bought into a lot of what, you know, the Gracies did with jiu-jitsu and on the ground, but they didn't want one specific style. So they tried to meld everything together, which watered things down, which makes it not as good. But that's what big departments do.
Right. Is that what they still use today?
They still use it. It's called ARCON, Arrest and Control. And they still use a lot of the techniques that were first brought about. There's certain things that they'll do, you know, to change them every now and then, but it's still basically the same type of program.
Right. Okay. Well, then, so from that time when you first entered the Gracie gym and started training with them, what happened from there through to, I guess, the creation of UFC?
Well, you know, I was just, again, I was a student of the Gracies, and there was a gentleman named Art Davey who came to the, you know, he started coming to the, when the school first opened up on Carson Boulevard in Torrance, he had this idea of, he wanted to do this fighting competition. And then Horian ended up becoming, you know, kind of interested in it. I was just a student. I was working out with Hickson, who was there at the time, and, you know, just trying to learn as much as I could. And then eventually it got to the point where it looked like, man, you know, this thing actually might take place. And then Hickson kind of went off and opened up his own school, and Hoist became the guy that was going to represent the family. And I ended up being Hoist's sparring partner, since they had a lot of big guys that were going to be part of the contest when they started putting actual names and faces to that competition. I became Hoist's sparring, one of his sparring partners, to get him ready for it. And that's how the UFC came about.
All right. So then what about you becoming a referee? Because I know, is it UFC 2 was your first refereeing match?
Yeah. Yeah. If you go back and you watch UFC 1, the very first fight was a fight between a man named Gerard Gourdeau, who was from Holland, and a sumo wrestler from Hawaii, Taylor Tuli. You know, Taylor Wiley is his real name, but they called him Taylor Tuli. And in that fight, you know, the referees that were brought in from Brazil. And the referee for that fight was a man named João Barreto, who was a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu under Elio Gracie, Horian's father. And, you know, absolutely, you know, knew how to, you know, handle himself. But part of the whole aspect of the show at that time was the referee was not supposed to stop the fight. The corner could stop the fight by throwing in the towel. The fighter could stop the fight by tapping, but the referee was not supposed to interfere with the fight. And Taylor comes over and tries to take Gerard down, and Gerard sidesteps him. And then as Taylor hits the ground, Gerard's, you know, takes a step and kicks him in the face, and a tooth goes flying over the top of the cage. And then he hits him with a right hand, and Joao Bejeto comes in and stops it based upon the fact, look at, he sees that Taylor, you know, is not in a position to fight, and he thinks this, you know, shouldn't go on. And they actually have this argument. You'll see Horian Gracie coming up to the side of the cage, and he's arguing with Joao Bejeto. They're speaking Portuguese, but if you understand it, they're arguing back and forth about Horian saying, you're not supposed to stop it. And Joao Bejeto is saying, this guy can't fight. And that's what got me my job, that incident right there, because Horian came to me, and I was at UFC 1. I was there with him and with Hoyce, and he said, hey, I need you to be a referee for me. And I told him, I said, I don't know how to referee. And he goes, no. And he says, part of my qualifications, according to him, was, he says, you know how to fight, you know, better than most of these guys. He says, and you're not, you know, it doesn't bother you to see someone get hurt. And so that was my qualifications. And so that's how I got the job at UFC 2.
Right. Well, I'm actually in the process of interviewing Dan Severn. We started like the first 20 minutes, and then he had to stop, and we're going to pick it up later this week. But I know he was one of the big greats, and then Don Fry was a fireman as well. It was a very different dynamic back then, though, where they almost had it like a video game, like kung fu against karate and yeah, sumo against kickboxing. So what did you think of that element? And then were you part of how it changed? Was it part of your input that made it manifest to what it is now?
Yeah, it's if you look back, you know, what the UFC started out, you know, each person involved with it had their own ideas of what they wanted. Art Davey, who was the guy who is the creator of it, he wanted to say, all right, who is the toughest man alive? That was his real idea. I want to know who's the best fighter. Horian looked at it as an infomercial. Hey, you know, and you can, you know, and it worked for him, because at the time that, you know, I was working out, you know, when I first was working out with Horian, he probably had 40 students, you know, and then by the time the UFC came along, he probably had somewhere around 100 to 120 students. And wow, a week after the UFC, he had 500, you know, and that's what he wanted. He used it like it was an infomercial for Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, saying, look, you can be the smaller guy and win the fight. You just have to have the technical skills. You got to know what, you know, areas to bring people into that you can control it, where they don't know what they're doing. And it worked. It worked beautifully for him. And that was his, you know, concept of, you know, why he was part of it. It was to push Gracie Jiu-Jitsu out into the world and make people understand that grappling was a superior form of fighting. If you understood what you were doing and your opponent didn't, you were going to have a great advantage. And, you know, you can see the results, you know, from UFC 1 through UFC, you know, even going through 10, 11, it took up to UFC 14 for a striker to actually be the guy that he was winning this. And because grappling took, you know, through Hoyce into Dan Severn, you know, into Don Fry, who utilized both, being he was a wrestler out of Arizona State, but he utilized boxing skills. You know, he became, you know, really good at it. Then Mark Coleman was the next one, who was an Olympic wrestler. Wrestlers and grapplers were the ones that dominated the actual activity. You know, what I did with it is, yeah, after I did UFC 2, I went to Horian and said, hey, I will never do that again. You know, and he was going to get somebody seriously hurt. And it was, Horian cared about his brother, but he wasn't worried about, hey, if you're not smart enough to know how to fight, that's your problem. That's the way Horian looked at it. And so he was not worried about these other people getting hurt. And I was trying to do what he wanted in saying, okay, I'm not going to stop the fight. It needs to be the corner or the fighter. But sometimes the corners were too stupid to understand, you know what, your guy is done. And sometimes the fighters were so done, they, you know, their brains aren't working. They can't tap out. And so it was a problem. And so I went to him after that, you know, the second show, and I said, hey, you know, I cannot do that again. You're going to get somebody seriously hurt. I'm supposed to stand there while someone is stomping on a person's head and their corner's too stupid to stop the fight. I can't do this. And he says, well, what would you want? I said, look, I need to be able to stop the fight. If that fighter cannot intelligently defend themselves, I need to be able to stop the fight. And he looked at it and said, okay, you know, if they can't intelligently defend themselves. And so we talked about it, and that was really the first rule thing that I put in there. And with every show that I did, I added rules. You know, fish hooking was put in there. You know, no putting your finger into a cut or orifice was another. It's still part of, both of those are still part of the rules today. You know, no grabbing of the gloves or the trunks. That's part of the rules today. I was put in there by me. I put in, you know, all the rules that are still there today were basically put in by me eventually going through the first 25 UFCs. Those are all the same rules that stand today.
Right. Now, are there any rules that were put in that you now wish weren't there?
Oh, there are rules that are put in. You know, when you look at when we did the unified rules back in 2001, you know, what they did is they took the rules that I had come up with the UFC, and they added a couple more. They added, you know, no downward elbow strikes. It's a dumb rule. It's stupid. It has no place in the sport because that elbow strike doesn't have any true power to it and doesn't have a whole effect. It's different types of elbows that cause a lot more problems than that, but those are legal, and that's one that's not. And it's just out of people's lack of knowledge that it's that way, and it needs to be changed. Someday maybe it will be, but, you know, who knows? But there's a, you know, most of the rules have worked. You know, there was a couple of things. You know, at the time, before the unified rules, if you were a down fighter, the fighter that was standing above you couldn't even kick you. And that was changed during the unified rules. It was changed where you could kick him to the body. So there was things that they added. There was things that, you know, they took away, but overall the standardized set of rules have basically stayed the same.
Right. Yeah. Cause I know the Pride organization, you could soccer kick to the face, couldn't you? That was always pretty brutal to watch.
Yeah, you could. And it's, you know, when you look at that, you know, they allowed stomps and they allowed, you know, kicks to the head of a grounded fighter. And you can look at it. The problem is if you truly understand fighting and you understand fighters, the stomps worked against you unless the fighter that you were competing against was hurt. If they were hurt, the stomp was effective, but you'd already had them hurt. And for that type of activity, it was too much damage that could be inflicted upon the person for it to be relative in the fight. So that was why we had taken it out, you know, but, you know, Japan had their own ideas, and Pride was a great organization and they put on some really good fights. And overall MMA around the world, each place does things a little bit different. Would I like to see it where it's all exactly the same? Yes. And that's good because it's good for the fighters and it's good for the fans. It's good for the officials. It's good for everyone, but it doesn't, you know, in the end, you know, change what the sport is.
Right. Now, you said in 14 was when the strikers start winning. Which striker was that?
That was Maurice Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Maurice Smith came in, and he previously had beaten Marcus Silvera, a guy named Conan, and that was an extreme fighting, and then he was pulled into the UFC, and his match was against Mark Coleman, and he beat Mark Coleman. And, you know, Maurice learned how to defend himself on the ground, learned how to use a butterfly guard very effectively to control his opponent if the opponent took him down. And he used cardiovascular conditioning. He used his ability to be in better condition than his opponent and wear his opponent out and then just systematically beat them down with striking. That's how Maurice came in and was effective. And it worked for him, and he was a great champion.
Okay, now what year did they start testing for performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, when you say testing for performance-enhancing drugs, that's broken into two different realms. The first set of that was done by athletic commissions. And the athletic commissions, when they really started doing MMA more effectively right around 2001, they also started doing some testing. Now, was the testing, efficient? Was it effective? I don't believe so. I think guys were able to get past it because they knew when they were going to be tested, and that made it to where they could cheat. Today, athletic commissions still do testing. They do a much more comprehensive test, and they also do tests that are unknown as far as they will call the athlete, maybe make the athlete go to a specific diagnostic center where they live and have their blood drawn within this 6-hour window, 12-hour window, depending upon certain things. And they will do that. They will also test them when they come for the fight. And so the testing is a lot more. You can look at the UFC. The UFC has taken that as, even a step beyond with USADA. They utilize the United States Anti-Doping Agency to be the watchdog for their organization, because you need to understand the UFC isn't, a lot of people look at it like that's the sport. It's not. That's a promotion. There's a lot of promotions out there. The UFC is one of them. But the UFC has taken it upon themselves to spend about $5 to $6 million a year to pay for USADA to implement an anti-doping program on any contracted fighter that they have. And so if you are contracted under the guise of the UFC and you fight for them, USADA is there and will come to your door at any time. You have to inform them of your whereabouts, where you're going to be within a 2-hour window. There's a lot that goes on with it. It's not easy on the athletes. It's not easy on the promotion. But it is the most effective and truly the only way to try to combat performance-enhancing drugs.
Right, yeah, because you definitely see a difference between the older generation of UFC fighters and then also some that came over from Japan that went into the UFC. And then just physically, as a complete, bystander, you could see the difference in the muscle mass and tone.
Yeah, you saw a lot of guys that were world champions and they were the best. And then when the USADA program came in, all of a sudden they couldn't win a fight. And you can look and you can say, well, I kind of have an idea why. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's just on a bad losing streak. But it definitely changed the careers for some fighters.
Yeah, yeah. But, it's good if it made it fair and made it healthier for them long run.
It's so hard for people to understand because – you can look at baseball or, something like that. And it's, guys use performance enhancing drugs and they had a curler in the Winter Olympics here. He was utilizing performance enhancing drugs. You go, why? But whatever. Okay. But fighting is the one thing that it's different because you are inflicting damage onto another human being. And that damage can intensify based upon you taking those drugs. So, there's two sides to every story, but I always look at it, if I had a choice of everyone could be able to use whatever they want or no one could use anything, I would take nobody using anything. That's the fairest.
Yeah, I would agree as well. So a side note from that with, where the UFC is now or MMA is, and we've seen such a shift, there's the wrestlers winning for a while, then there's the boxers, then, Machida's winning with what seems like older fashioned karate moves. If you could create the perfect MMA fighter for 2018, what kind of ratio of which martial arts would you have them do?
Things haven't changed that much in what you want to do. There is a difference in jiu-jitsu has a different slot now compared to what they had in the past. Jiu-jitsu was the number one thing for a long time, the submission game. Wrestling has been the thing that, allows you to either, keep the fight in the standing position or take the fight to the ground if you can get it there, if that's what's going to work best for you. The striking game is obviously, you've got to be able to know how to protect yourself because that's the way the fight starts. The real difference that you'll see in fighters today, they all do the same things. They all practice. They practice their striking, be it both with hands, feet, elbows, knees. They practice their wrestling, both offensive takedown-wise and defensive wrestling. And they have to have a great knowledge. They don't have to be the best submission person as far as applying the submission, but they absolutely have to know how to defend that submission. Because if they don't, they're going to get caught. The real difference that you'll see in the fighters today is their ability to transition from one element to the next in a fluid fashion where it doesn't look like there's a break in the continuity of what they're doing. All of a sudden, they're doing this wrestling technique, and here comes a spinning elbow off of it. That's the transitional phase that you're seeing the best fighters being able to utilize now compared to their opponents. They're just smoother, faster, and more fluid in that transitional phase than what you saw in the past.
Right. Okay, so the same question now, but not in the cage, outside. Someone who's looking to defend themselves, God forbid it's one-on-one, two-on-one, you know, whatever the real world ratio would be in a fight. What martial arts and what ratio would you advise them?
You know, I hate to say it. The first martial arts I would tell them to utilize is called the run.
I agree 100%. But let's say you're in the corner now, so that's being exhausted.
If someone can't catch you, they can't hurt you. You know, it's so true that sometimes, you know, our alligator mouths override our hummingbird asses. We get ourselves into situations that we should never have been put, you know, in the first place. Now, sometimes those things come at you and then you haven't done anything to instigate it. But the ability to, you know, you've got to know everything. You can't sit there and say, I can rely on one specific thing based upon that's going to keep me safe, because you never know who is the person that's attacking you. It used to be where you could say, man, you know, if you know how to fight on the ground, you're going to have a great advantage, because people don't know how to do that. And it's a different world now. A lot of people do. You know, you do need to understand how to strike and how to accept a blow and not let it affect you. That's something that most people can't do. And that's the difference that you'll see, you know, when you watch a schoolyard fight and you watch a professional. A professional is, you know, getting hit and their eyes stay exactly on that problem that they have. While the schoolyard fight, the person gets hit and now their head is turning away from the problem, which is not going to get rid of the problem. It's only going to intensify it, but it's a natural reaction. And these are the types of things that you have to work at in trying to learn how to deal with those things. But, you know, when we to look at one art, I would tell someone, don't look at one art. You know, the world of martial arts has changed more in the last 25 years than it's changed in the 200 years prior to it. So if you're going to go learn how to defend yourself, then go learn from a place that teaches multiple elements of the martial arts. They teach the stand-up, they teach the ground.
All right. And then what level of sparring should that school have? Because I was training in Shootbox when they were in LA for a while, and that was the closest thing to Fight Club I've ever been a part of. I mean, it was I've still got, you know, my nose is sideways and, you know, yeah, all kinds of injuries from that, but Jesus Christ, the sparring was ridiculous. Now I don't think that's maybe the right way, because yeah, you know, it's a little too much, but I know now in from what I understand from the fighters that I talk to, the heavy sparring, they've kind of gone away from that a little bit, because they're realizing that they're doing a lot of damage in the gym before they even get into the fights.
Exactly. And it's similar to like saying, you know, I call fighters, they're like sports cars, you know, and you don't take your Ferrari and run it into a wall and expect it to run very long. Okay. You can't do that. And you can't do that as an average person wanting to just be able to defend yourself. I'm not telling you that you don't need to at certain times elevate that style that you're incorporating into a full contact, but 50% contact compared to 100%. There's no reason, if you're getting damaged inside of the gym, you're not learning. You're just getting damaged. Everything about being in the gym is learning. Now, there's times that we'll go at 30%, there's times that we'll kick it up to 50, and we might kick it up to 70, but there's no purpose in going 100% in the gym. All that's going to happen is you're going to get injured. You're going to get injured, or somebody else is going to get injured. And so we've learned that, you know what, technique and learning of technique and the repetition of doing that technique time after time after time is what's going to make you able to perform that technique under stress, under a situation where it just becomes part of who you are. You don't think about it, you just do it. That's what we want to see. And so again, don't go to a place that you're getting beat up. If you're getting beat up, there's something wrong with the instruction.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Now, I want to just touch on one more thing about the UFC and then get to some wrap-up questions, because I know we're getting close to the hour now. We are 2018. Obviously, we're seeing the UFC as it is at the moment. Where do you see UFC, Bellator, MMA in general in 5 years from now?
You know, the sport of MMA it's plateaued a little bit. I believe that it has plateaued in the fact that there's so much out there. There's so many shows out there. The UFC puts on, let's say, 40 to 45 shows a year. All right. Bellator puts on 24 to 26 shows a year. ACB puts on 26 shows a year. LFA is putting on 30 shows. There's so many promotions out there putting on so many shows that I believe both promotions, as far as being the big ones, being the UFC and Bellator, need to start look towards almost like, you know, you get those specials where you get a card that has all the big matchups that you've been waiting for. And those are the ones that are going to draw the eyes. You've got to get people to start watching your product so they can start to learn who these younger fighters are. One of the problems that the UFC is going to have in 2018 as they're starting to change it is a lot of their fighters are older, and they're having a lot of older fighters out there, and they're winning some and they're losing some, but bringing in new talent is something that they're always working at doing, and they do a good job of it. It's just sometimes because you keep on bringing back these older fighters, that younger talent is still at the bottom of the card and a lot of people don't see them. And it's time for those young guns to be able to get into that higher position on that card so more people are seeing them. Same with Bellator. Bellator right now has just an incredible stable of young fighters, but they're utilizing older fighters to try to bring eyes on to the younger fighters. And you got to be smart in how you're doing it. But the sport of MMA is not going to go anywhere. You know, can it plateau out? Sure. Every sport does. Every sport has high seasons and low seasons. And the difference with fighting is we don't have seasons. It goes year round. So there's going to be time. There's going to be shows that people watch, and there's going to be shows that they don't. They're going to watch the shows where they recognize the name. They recognize the person. They like something about that fighter. They like something about the way that fighter fights. They like something about their that personality that they have. That's what people grab onto. That's why, you know, a Ronda Rousey was so, you know, popular. That's why Conor McGregor is so popular, is there's people that want to see them win, and there's people that want to see them lose, and they'll both tune in to hopefully get that what they want.
Yeah, I was an avid fan, would watch every single fight, and it was probably 6-7 years ago when, you know, the TV shows were on. They had that combat sport where they were on that Circle One. It was more like a kickboxing show, and it seemed like every single channel had hours and hours and hours of MMA. And I think that time the market just got saturated, and it was supply and demand. They didn't make the consumer wait anymore. And I think when you make us wait, we do line up and go see those shows with those names.
Yeah, it's the truth, you know, because in the early days with the UFC, first off, it was hard to see because it was, you know, off of cable for a while. But, you know, even in the, you know, 2000s, you had about 8 shows, 10 shows a year. And so it was almost like every other month you were getting a show, and it made you wait, but it made you look forward to it. And right now, you know, I can tell you what the last UFC was, but most people aren't able to tell you that or what the next one is, because the next one is coming. You could have the greatest fight in the world, and then you have a fight next week, and it erases that greatest fight in the world. And sometimes it's good to let things, you know, sit there and to saturate in and to marinate a little bit about how special that was. And sometimes we run ourselves over coming up with our next show.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just want to talk quickly about what you're doing now before we ask those last few questions. So you refereed, well, let me rephrase the question. How many years did you end up refereeing, and then what led you towards the transition that you're doing now?
I refereed basically from 1994 until 2018. December 30th, 2017 was the last UFC I did. So basically 24 years almost was how long I refereed. And, I can't tell you that, you know, I ever had a bad time doing it. I loved what I did. Never ever, did I want to stop. It's just that, after a while, I'm older and I'm breaking, and I have responsibilities as far as, what I, have to do to pay bills. And if I'm not working as a referee, I do have a pension with the LAPD, but if I'm not working as a referee, well, I'm not getting paid. So it's a matter of, I had an opportunity to get a job with a company in Bellator that I always loved working for Bellator. They were a great company. They treated me really well, as a referee. They're always friendly, and that's a big part of, it's fun to go work their shows. And when I was given the opportunity to be a broadcaster for them, when you're in my position and you're a nobody is the way I look at it. And I have all these broadcasters out there that are trying to get this job, and I'm going to get the ability to try for, one of the biggest jobs there is in the sport of MMA. And to turn it down after I was offered it, that wouldn't have been the brightest move on my part. So that was a big part of why I made the move.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, I don't think you're a nobody. I think if you use the word UFC or the letters UFC with one particular face through the whole thing, then you would be it. So you're certainly somebody in MMA. So it's a great choice to get you to be a voice for Bellator now. So I want to do some closing questions then. So first, the question I ask normally is books that recommend people. But before I ask that, you wrote a book yourself called Let's Get It On. How long ago did you write that, and what made you write that book?
Man, I wrote that, probably started that somewhere around 2010 or so. It probably came out somewhere around 2011, 2012. I'm not sure. But I wrote it, honestly, the reason I wrote it, I had a Loretta Hunt was the person that helped write, and she kept telling me that, she goes, you need to tell people the truth of what happened, because there are people out there trying to rewrite history and try to say that they were part of things that they were never part of. And there was a person in Jeff Blatnick, who was an Olympic wrestler, who came as a broadcast color commentator to the UFC at UFC 4, who fell in love with the sport, who gave the credibility that he had attained through his wrestling career and through surviving Hodgkin's disease twice as a cancer survivor. Jeff loaned the credibility that he had acquired to the UFC. He tried to get people to understand how special the athletes were. And he was being written out of the history of it. And that was a big part of me writing the book. Is I wanted people to know, hey, these are the people that actually did something to keep the sport alive. These are the people that actually did the work, not the people that you think. And so that was really the reason that she talked me into writing that book.
Well, that sounds like a great reason to put pen to paper to me. All right, so apart from your book, are there any other books that you like to recommend to people? It can be about the sport, it can be about something completely different.
Oh my God. As far as what I would read?
Yeah, anything.
I think there's been a couple of books that have been on MMA that have been good. I usually like to read, I read factual things. I read autobiographies. I read things about people that interest me. And I read things about people that I look at as being special, being the uncommon person that didn't take no for an answer, that didn't stop when everyone else would have, that kept going forward. And so I don't care what it is as far as what the person does. Whatever you as the individual like, find somebody in that realm that has had failures, because we all do, you know, has continued on in hard times, has worked their, you know, their butt off, you know, doing the everyday job and then going off and doing things to make themselves better towards that thing that, you know, is the dream that drives them. You know, those are the books that I go for. And I also go for, you know, things like, you know, Lone Survivor. I like things about people that, you know, like Marcus Luttrell, that they don't talk about how special they are. They talk about how special the people around them were that made the things that they did special.
Yeah, that, I think that's a great, great book. I love that book. So what about a movie and or a documentary?
Oh, my God. Probably my favorite movie of all time is Braveheart. And it's because it's about a guy that, you know what, he doesn't settle for the average. He makes things happen. And I love that movie. You know, my other one that, you know, when I was a kid, Rocky. I've probably seen Rocky 50 times. You know, but again, it's about a guy that doesn't quit. And that's the motto that I like to live my life by and try to get other people to understand, man, don't put, you know, stops there. Everything in life has got barriers. Your job is to get past the barrier. And so I love that. And documentaries wise, man, there's so many out there. I'm trying to think of what I, if you like, you know, mixed martial arts, there's a, you know, documentary on Beyond the Glory, I think is one that talks about MMA, but there's one that's on the UFC that was really good. It was done a while back. There's also one coming out on a guy that was a special guy in the sport that never fought, and his name was Charles Mask Lewis. And there's a documentary coming out on Mask to show a guy that he wasn't the fighter. He wasn't, you know, the guy that was in the cage, but it was a guy that helped make the sport of MMA special, and he did it in his own way. And that's what anybody can do if they put their mind to it.
Right. And he was from Tap Out, wasn't he?
Yeah. Charles was the founder of Tap Out.
Right. Yeah, I remember they were pretty much synonymous with UFC in that period. So it definitely was a huge part of their success, I would say. All right. The next question is there a person that you would suggest to come on this show as a guest, or someone else that you would recommend that you think would be good for the first responders of the world to hear?
Yeah, you need to have my dad on. He's way better than me.
I'd love to.
He's a... You know, my dad is a guy, I don't have many heroes in my life. And I understand why sons many times say, my dad's my hero. But, you know, my dad grew up in a very hard life. He made the most out of everything he could. Everything that he was part of, people ended up saying, oh, that was special. Where there's a reason why that everything that he was part of was special. It's because he was special. He left, you know, LAPD after 25 years being, you know, the number one guy in the job that he did. And then he went and took that further and helped police officers all the way from the time he retired back in 1985 to just today. He's still doing cases for police officers. A lot of the time doing it gratis, not getting paid anything. And he's been one of the most successful expert witnesses there is. He's written too many books. He has taught too many police officers to name. And people should listen to him, even though sometimes he can get on a rant.
Well, I got plenty of audio space, so we're fine there. So, I mean, joking apart, I would love to. So maybe down the road we can figure out how to do that too.
I'll try to set that up for you.
Excellent. All right. Last question before we talk about where we can find the book and all your projects now. What do you do to decompress when you're not commentating or refereeing?
I get on a motorcycle and I ride. I get out in the open. I get out into to nature, and I get, you know, whether it be on a dirt bike or on a street bike, I get out and just, you know, sometimes with my wife on the back, sometimes no one on the back, and I just ride.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Okay, so where can people find the book? And then are there any other areas on the internet, social media, that people can kind of learn about you, reach out to you, that kind of thing?
I think the book you can still get on Amazon. You go to Amazon.com to get the book. It's Let's Get It On, The Making of the Ultimate Referee or something like that. I can't even remember the title, but it's something like that. And then if someone ever wants to find out something about me, they can go on Twitter or Instagram. It's John McCarthy MMA on Twitter and Instagram. And I ask, I'll answer questions. A lot of people ask questions about MMA or things like that. And so I have a hashtag that's hashtag AskBJM. They can always ask a question and I will eventually get to it, I promise.
Brilliant. Well, thank you again so, so much. I mean, I know how busy you must be with this, not only a full career in PD and then a full career as a referee, but now you're commentating for Bellator as well. Thank you so much for taking the time. I would love to interview your dad. I mean, if someone pioneered the LAPD SWAT and then had that full career, that would be another story that needs to be told. So I appreciate your time. And I know that all first responders, but certainly the law enforcement side, are going to really draw a lot from this interview.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.